Hello everyone, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to Season 6 of our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians and other victims of the research bug.
We'll talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And as always, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this? Today on Archive Fever, we are recording in Sydney on Gadigal land, where we are speaking to Jazz Money, an acclaimed Wiradjuri artist, poet and filmmaker described by Vogue Australia as a multidisciplinary force. Jazz's first poetry collection, How to Make a Basket, was published in 2021. It was a bestseller that won the David Inayapan Award. And their next collection, Mark the Dawn, will be published by University of Queensland Press in late 2024. Jazz's artworks have been displayed everywhere from Sydney's Museum of Contemporary Art to Paris's Palais de Tokyo. And their first feature film, Wenangana, premiered in late 2023 at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. Commissioned by the National Film and Sound Archive, Wenangana is composed entirely of archival footage by or about First Nations people. As Jazz puts it, Wenangana, quote, was born from a desire to make sense of the archival inheritances that shape our present realities. It's an extraordinary film and it's touring nationally and internationally in 2024. Jazz, welcome to Archive Fever.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we'll dive into Wenangana in a moment, but first let's go back to where your Archive Fever began. This film is obviously made by someone who has a very keen awareness of the power and often the violence of archives. So I'm fascinated to know, where does that awareness stem from?
I think it is probably more common than not for First Nations people to have an archival tick. Particularly someone who's had the privileges that I have had of having a university education and sort of being surrounded by spaces of academia for that period and seeing so many absences. And I guess also as a queer person and a First Nations person, having a lens through these official histories that totally doesn't align with my understandings of what I've been raised with, of what I've experienced, of what I know to be true. And so that's probably where it begins, you know. It starts with family. It starts with a fascination of what's happened and what's come before. Like the title of your podcast, once you get it, it's really hard to shake the fever.
And did you grow up around those kind of conversations, or was that something that happened more later when you went to uni?
I grew up more around silences and absences from the conversation. There wasn't harmful intent, but there was just a lot of mystery. There was a lot of unknown, and there was a lot of things that we weren't meant to talk about. And so I think that was the intriguing thing, that once I sort of had the power to begin to dig, you keep digging, right?
And what does it feel like to you when you're in the midst of digging, you know, when you're kind of in the grip of doing research for the film or any project? Like, do you have a sense of kind of an archive fever taking over you?
Oh, totally. I actually had it just the other day. Mm-hmm. I was meant to be doing a million other things, but I suddenly found myself interested in this early 20th century anthropologist, Branislav Malinowski. And once I started looking, hours went past and I was so happy. Like, it was such that flow state of madness and being like, oh, there's more, and it's weirder and it's weirder and it keeps going, and then you've got the podcasts and you're watching the films, and like, it just took over. And at the end of the day I was like, wow, none of those deadlines got met,
but I discovered a lot of interesting facts. Yeah.
And maybe it'll come out in a poem, you know, you never know where it's going to lead.
Do you feel that sense of slipping down the rabbit hole in your body? Is it quite a corporal feeling for you?
I would say it feels like the calm of being in a meditative state where you're just like allowing your interest to guide you so deeply, and there's no responsibility in those moments.
And as we said in the introduction, I mean, you're this kind of triple threat, artist, poet and filmmaker.
None of them make any money, but if you do all three at once, you can kind of begin to cobble something together.
And at least you seem threatening.
No threat to the Forbes rich list.
Yeah. No, but maybe no threatening to the rich species.
So did you set out to kind of work across all those different fields, or did that kind of evolve more organically?
You'd be mad to try and set out to work across those different fields. No, I originally, when I left high school, trained as a filmmaker. I went to film school. I had an incredible time, but I realised I didn't have a heap to say at 19. And once I started working in the film industry, I was pretty repulsed by it and sort of recoiled and was sort of guided very organically to working as an arts worker and had a filmmaking background. So I spent a number of years working as a videographer for arts museums, amongst, you know, a million other things. So I was sort of like one foot in the art world with a background in film and also writing poetry in the solitary, weird nature that poets write, and for a long time didn't sort of reveal that to anyone. As you said in my intro, I was really, really lucky to win a manuscript award in 2020, the David Unaipon Award, and that suddenly led to a lot of people that I knew in the arts world going like, oh, well, poetry would be great with art, so like, why don't you come in and try that out? That was really informed by community. I'm really lucky now that I get to work in the visual arts as an artist and to continue to write poetry and still have a filmmaking practice. It feels like a bonkers thing to be trying to do, but it's really, really fun.
Have you felt any pressure to kind of, you know, choose a lane, or as it sounds like people have been quite supportive?
Well, I often think that for First Nations people, we don't categorise our cultural output, right? Yeah. Like land is country, is body, is kin, language is culture, is song, is story, is ceremony, is us. And so with that understanding, it's not me trying to have an output that fits different forms, but actually trying to find ways of communicating the same story in different modes.
As you said, you trained as a filmmaker some years ago, but Winungana is your first feature film. It was obviously a collaboration with the National Film and Sound Archives. How did that relationship develop? Did they approach you or did you go to them?
They had a call out looking for a First Nations filmmaker to get into the archive. And I saw that and really just thought, well, I have no idea what you have. Like, yeah. I've got no idea what's on the shelf. I've got no idea what it would mean to make a film with the archive. But my practice as a filmmaker, the thing I've always been gravitated to is editing. Mm. And so as someone who writes poetry, I think film editing and writing poetry are like very much the same craft.
It's all about taking things away, distilling in a way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, you know, pairing together similar or disparate images to create meaning.
Yeah,
you
juxtaposition.
Know? Juxtaposition, yeah, yeah. Or complementary, or how you play with surprise, how you play with narrative, how you draw out some things and then pace other things. And I feel like both of them, there is a really fluid sense of being guided by the form and guiding the form. So the National Film and Sound Archive put out this call out, and I wrote a proposal for Winungana, which was very much saying, I don't know what you have, but I'm very suspicious of it. And I would like to have a dig around and see if my suspicions are correct. And to their credit, they accepted that proposal, which was mostly a fuck you to the archives.
Yeah.
Am I allowed to swear?
I think that's the title of this episode, yeah, yeah. A fuck you to the archives.
Great. And, you know, with good reason to be suspicious.
Can I ask what the actual digging around looked like? So the application was accepted, they allowed you into the hallowed space. Was it then a process like we're familiar with on Trove? Is the archive digitalised so that you can go through a catalogue and put in a keyword that you used to find your way in? Or was it a more romantic version of you kind of walking down aisles with cans of film on the side and pulling things off and holding it up to the light to see what might be on the negative? Tell us what digging looked like in FSA.
I wish I could say that it was the latter. I did walk through the hallowed halls and smelt the vinegar of degrading film.
Does it smell like vinegar?
Yeah. I think the conservationists are panicked, but yeah. Maybe I shouldn't say that. So they let me into the digitized collection, which really narrowed down the scope, but also was so illuminating as to what had been prioritized to be digitized.
Do you know what proportion of the overall holdings had been digitized?
I have been told. I want to say it's like 8%.
Yeah,
you know,
so
it's small, but they have film, television, radio, audio recordings, home recordings, photos, posters. Like there is so many objects. Yeah, I should fact check myself, but I feel like when I went in, it was quite a small proportion, which in a way helped narrow down the focus of that digging, but it also was frustrating to see how many things, you know, weren't quite ready. Like there weren't any music videos. Gutted. I was gutted. So it was a keyword search system and it was really scattered. I had a very short period when I could do the research, and that was digging through the collection, searching things out. I had to request everything from the NFSA and they would put it on a big hard drive and courier it to me. So I ended up watching hundreds of hours of footage and listening to hundreds of hours of audio. And as I was receiving it, I was trying to sort of categorize and edit and script the project in real time, because my proposal got accepted, I think, in, say, November or December of 2021. And with the original schedule, I had to have my finished draft for the film in April.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's nuts.
It was nuts.
And that's also just after your first book came out, so you were
touring
that as well.
And that's true, yeah. So I was spending really long days editing in the suite and just watching some really, really beautiful clips, but also some totally devastating and infuriating things, and just sort of having to oscillate between like rage and and work a lot of the time.
Can you give us an example of a piece of archive that would send you into a rage?
There's so many lies in the audiovisual archives that have been used to justify the dispossession of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander land, the justifications of terra nullius, the perpetual degradation and deficit purportedly representing our communities. So it was pretty constant, and I was trying to find more positive representations of our community than negative. And that was really, really hard, because the overwhelming representation of First Nations people in the National Film and Sound Archive is harmful. Some of the stuff that was particularly like confronting was things from sort of the first half of the 20th century, where words like settlers and invaders, white invaders was a phrase used in one of the early silent films to describe British arrival. It felt like a smoking gun, right? Mm-hmm. I felt like, well, you guys know, like all these culture wars and history wars that we've had across the last 100 years, like the evidence is there. And those were the moments where I think I felt particularly like infuriated, because I mean,
we're telling on ourselves.
Yeah. So you weren't even fucking smart enough to hide the evidence. Like it's all here. So those were the moments where I would sometimes just like, or other moments, I should say, like things that never should have been documented, and if they were documented, never should have been accessible to me. Like I saw initiation ceremonies from far north Queensland boys' ceremonies, and, you know, I was kind of watching these black and white clips for a moment before I realised what I was seeing, and then had to, you know, pull myself out of it and kind of try and take care of myself, like culturally sort of cleanse myself of these things that I shouldn't have been seeing. So it was a very physically confronting experience, as well as emotionally and psychologically.
I wanted to ask about that violence embedded in the taking a lot of these images, which, you know, were taken without people's consent and often of things that shouldn't have been recorded, like the initiation ceremonies. In choosing what images to then reproduce, I mean, how did you kind of navigate those questions? Was there a kind of consultation process with the descendants of people depicted or anything like that?
Yeah, it was a really, really rigorous process. Of course, it's super complicated because so often footage was taken or images recorded unconsensually. And that includes not recording who, where, when. So many questions. And I worked with the archive for over a year on community consultation, which was really involved and really hard, but important. That was what blew out our original schedule by a year. But there was a few things at play. One of them was I kept being confronted by the fact that there were these representations of people that were really derogatory, but the person in the footage is still a sovereign, powerful, dignified human being and should be treated as such. And I felt like I was having this sort of rehabilitative relationship with a lot of this footage by seeing these beautiful people and seeing the truth of their situation, everything that is beyond the construction of the lens, and saying, like, well, how can we restore honour to you? I don't think we can restore honour to this horrible footage, but that's not really the point of this project. The point is to recognise that the archive is not the thing that sits on the shelf. The archive is the body, and the body holds the story of everything that we've been through, every loving moment and every moment of struggle, and it's held in this depiction. It isn't the depiction, you know? So that was the thing that kept guiding me through these clips. And ultimately, I didn't use so much stuff because it wasn't mine to access. And Wananga is not a perfect film by any stretch. And I would say that I don't know if there's an ethical way to enter these spaces, right? But I did a few times. I wanted to quit and run away from it because it was too hard and it was too confronting. And I didn't feel like I was the right person to be in that space. But it's not a given that me or anyone from my community is welcome into these archival spaces. I mean, people have fought for generations to have access to this documentation that has been taken from us, of us. And so I felt that I couldn't run away because the responsibility, I'd put my hand up for it and I'd said, I'm good for it. And then I got in there and I was like, well, I need to be responsible with the access I've been given and hopefully keep the door open and push it wider and make sure that more people are coming in and we are disseminating this knowledge wider. If I run away, I've done nothing.
Yeah, I was just contemplating listening to you there, Jazz, thinking that it's a huge responsibility, but also possibly an opportunity. How much were you able to feed back to the curators and the collectors at the National Film and Sound Archive your experience of going through their holdings and be able to inform them about culturally appropriate ways in which to display, lend? My sense is that many of the national cultural institutions want to do the right thing but don't quite know what that is and are very under-resourced to be able to follow it through anyway.
Yeah, I would say that's a sound assessment. I think it was quite a confronting experience for the National Film and Sound Archive. I suspect that they didn't quite know what they were getting themselves into. None of us did, really. It was the first time that they had done a commission like this, the first time they'd invited an artist into the collection in this way. And so we were all learning together. But yeah, I do think it was hopefully a period of growth for them. When I started on the project, there were no First Nations staff working at the institution, which was pretty hard for me, for the holdings, for the community. And since then, wonderful Jill Moody is the leader of the Indigenous program there and I believe is developing a team. So it feels like there's been a great deal of growth, even in the short amount of time that I've been working with them. I get the sense that it is one of their priorities of how to do this better and how to be a more responsible organisation. But like you said, resourcing, it's not sexy work, right? In terms of disseminating footage out, I mean, something that has struck me every time we've had a screening of Wananganar is someone will come up to me afterwards and be like, that's my auntie, that's my family, we didn't know about that footage. Can I have it? And I have the great joy of saying, like, yes, you can. That's part of the deal of this project is that we are pushing this information out and it is an important process of repatriation and rematriation. That's a great joy and a great outcome to be able to even tell people that this thing is there, right? Like, so many folk don't know. Why would they? But there are holdings that represent our families and our communities and our country. They go back a ways. So there's a lot to be learned. And if we can get more people with eyes on them, we all benefit, right? Because we all get to receive the complex information and the story behind what is depicted if it goes back into the hands of community. Or actually, I should say, whatever community wants. If community wants to take stuff back and never mention it again, that is their right.
And I've seen that in action at the Bukulange Mulka Centre in Yirrkala, where they have a vast collection now of film and sound archive because the Yolngu people have been studied by anthropologists, as you were saying, and filmmakers for, you know, going back decades now. But every time they discover that there are things in various collections, it does come back and it is constantly accessible by the community.
They're such rock stars up there.
Yeah, it's so cool. And you just see kids sitting in the little theatrette there or playing on the computers, accessing things and just watching on loop all of this material, absorbing it, interpreting it.
It's so cool.
Jez, Wananga has a really kind of distinctive five-act structure, which I wanted to ask about. Did you kind of come to the project with this structure in mind, or was it something that sort of the archive revealed to you?
I actually had it written from the very first proposal, this five-act structure, because I think it was maybe having a poet's approach to things. It felt like a formula that I could enter the archive with and not be overwhelmed. And I also had this sense that making a feature length from archival footage would be really, really hard, but maybe making five short films from archival footage was an achievable goal.
Okay. Break it down.
I think it really helped me understand what I was looking for and to sort of have a focus and a guide. But it also was quite surprising at the end of the project to read back over the original proposal and go like, oh, wow, that is more or less the film. So I was surprised that it stayed true.
And as you've sort of mentioned already, the body is a huge theme in the film. Like, it sort of seems to me that the film in a way can be described as a conversation between the kind of colonial archive and the archive of the body, and they're sort of in dialogue together. Do you think that's a kind of fair way to think about it?
Yeah, there are so many tensions, right, in trying to look at these stories, but I think that is a good way to describe it. Maybe I'll describe the five-act structure for listeners, which is that the film is really bookended by these two chapters. The first one, looking at the body solo in the landscape, and there's a lot of dance and there's a lot of individualized gestures, and the final act is sort of the same again, but bodies in community, bodies in collective. I think the original title I gave to it was Collective Frenzy. The second act is quite brutal. It's looking at the colonial archive and very much the dispossession and the lies that have been told. The third act is all about protest and burning that down and cleansing what we've seen. And the fourth act is love and joy and bodies embracing and dancing and kissing and hugging and all the things that is actually the truth, you know? It is true that we have faced unbelievable horrors in our community and that that trauma lives on. But it is equally true that we are a community of love and joy and sexiness and strength and all the good things that our ancestors have gifted us. And that goes far, far, far further back than this colonial intervention of really recent times on this ancient continent. So I wanted to sort of honour ancestors by looking at all states.
That second act, which is really drawn from the colonial archive, as you say, and that's the demonstration of the lies, I found very hard to watch. Those are the bits that clearly sent you into a rage. I felt rageful, sickened. And I wondered about those in terms of archiving them, continuing to keep them in the archive, in terms of some of the debates that are going on around school libraries. I know at my local high school there was a move to remove material from the library that was produced in that earlier era where it was acceptable to perpetuate those lies through language and through imagery, through mythology. How do you feel about knowing that those archives still exist in that space, and do you think there is any rationale for culling them?
I think it would misrepresent the truth of what has happened here if we were to ignore or destroy the evidence that has been produced by the colonizer and the colonized. I think we need to remember what came before, because it gives context to everything that has happened since. It doesn't mean that we approach these archives and take them to be true, but to approach them and see how they represent power and mythology at any given moment, I think is an incredibly valuable thing to do. We just need to then have the awareness to understand the mode that these things were produced under and to who they serve. So it's interesting that that second chapter, which is very historical, was really put in because Wonangana was always intended to have its premiere screening in London. So it was always intended to be seen by international audiences, and I had this sense that I actually needed to provide more backstory than I would typically as someone who is really interested in this place and the stories of this place. And in doing so, in looking at these horrible, horrible stories, I realised, like, we still don't really talk about this here. Mm-hmm. We still don't really have an awareness. And also, when you look at the way our communities have been represented, you then understand how powerful it is to see images of us loving and hugging and dancing. You know, these beauty and celebration of beauty in rejection and in rebellion, in an radical act of defiance against these harmful images, is actually really important. I think it does help to understand why our love and joy is radical when you look at what has happened before. So, yeah, it's interesting that you said that you found it very hard to watch, because I believe you watched it at home, Claire, and whenever I do a screening in a cinema, I always make a point of standing up in front of everyone and saying, the second chapter is really, really hard, so go easy on yourself and go gently through that space, because there is a point and I'm taking you somewhere. But when people watch it at home, I can't.
To tell you the truth, I actually watched it on my laptop on an aeroplane. And I wanted to, like, hold my laptop up to, like, the people around me and say, can you people see what's going on here? This is what we did. And why doesn't everybody know this? And you should feel terrible. You should all feel as terrible as I feel right now.
You should just screen it on every flight between Sydney and Melbourne.
Say, maybe we should petition Qantas. Yeah. To have it on the in-flight player.
Yeah. Jazz, I also wanted to ask about the role of temporality in the film, because obviously kind of Western colonial archives are structured around linear time based on this sort of idea of, you know, time marching towards the future. But obviously First Nations cultures have different conceptions of time, which are much more circular. And maybe it was just me, but in watching the film, there seemed to be elements of that kind of embedded in both the five-act structure, which kind of begins and ends with the body in landscape. But also there's a lot of circular imagery in the film. In one of the acts, there's a car that drives around and around in circles. Yeah, I guess I wondered if this was sort of all a deliberate attempt to kind of speak back to the archive and insert different conceptions of time and being.
Well, thank you so much, because that makes me feel like I succeeded as a filmmaker with my intention. But yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I wanted to address deep time and understandings of time and place as they are true to this continent and to the people of this place, which is to say, you know, every time our foot falls on country, we are connected to every moment that has been there before and every moment that will come. And to tell a story of the archives of this place is to understand that it affects us in the then and in the now and in wherever time we operate. So, yeah, there is a lot of time jumping. There is a lot of moments where we have black and white footage juxtaposed up against something of today. sound that plays through time. There is this bit that you were sort of referencing there where there is this circular image, and then we have beautiful David Gulpilil's voice from Ten Canoes come in, and he says, "They're coming, my ancestors," and then it jumps to footage from the Sapphires. So trying to say that, like, they're all our, everyone is our ancestor in this long understanding. That is a story of archiving, as well, and what we prioritise and what we think is important was what I was really interested in.
Just to put a chronological timestamp on this question, you mentioned before that most of the material is produced about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people rather than by them, but some of it obviously is. Is there a date that you can put to when the archival holdings come into play in the collection that are by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people?
Yeah, it is pretty distinct. I think in the 70s you really feel the explosion of power, which isn't to say that it wasn't present in previously, but the way that it is depicted in the archive, I mean, I guess it's probably a post-referendum thing, but there is this outburst of creators telling their own stories from First Nations communities, and it's so beautiful to watch the archive because you see these sort of people that become incredibly familiar to us as they get older, these leaders in the film and television, acting, performance space. But there's clips of folk from, like, when they're teenagers in the 70s dancing and warming up and doing really daggy stuff. And it's so cool to see actually these germinations of things that start really, so much seems to start in Redfern with stuff like the Black Theatre Company that then ripples out.
Yeah, I was very struck by the amount of Deborah Mailman in the film. She appears.
Well, actually, that's just me showing my crush as well, because, like,
fair enough.
Yeah. Deborah Mailman in Radiance, every time she looks at the screen, you're just like, da-da-da-da-da, heartbeats.
Before we end, Jazz, I wanted to put to you a question we ask all our guests here at Archives Anonymous, which is, do you have a dirty little archive secret you're willing to share with us?
I have so many. I'm sure this is common for a lot of people as well, but I have a dirty fascination with the archival books section in op shops and vintage stores, particularly the really sus ones. And I love to buy those really horrible books that say stuff like Dreamtime of the Aborigines, and it's from 1930. You know, these books that are about First Nations communities that were produced in the early 20th century. I hate that they exist, and I hate that they could fall into someone else's hands, so I buy them, and I have just this foul little collection in my house.
Your own little, like, cursed archive.
Yeah, of, like, trouble.
And do you have any plans to, you know, cut them all up and turn them into kind of, well, you know, an art object,
or? The brilliant artist Allegamelia Baker, based down in Kernayurta, has this ongoing project that I'm sure you guys have probably discussed at some point or know about, which is a huge stack of these sorts of books. So I have thought to myself, one day I'll package them all up and send them down to Ali because she's the person for them. But for now, they just sort of freak my partner out.
And now we know where the high school libraries that are culling.
Yeah.
That material can just send it to Jazz Money, care of Archive Fever.
Yeah. And actually, I have to ask before we end, what does Wanangana mean?
Ah, good. Very good. It doesn't translate well into English because Wiradjuri is a language with so much philosophy and poetry and beauty that English falls flat. But it means approximately to know and to think and to remember all at once. So it was from the very, very beginning always the title of this project.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for joining us, Jazz. It's been a real treat to have you with us, and I did love the film so much. It's beautiful.
So to learn more about Jazz's work, you can visit their website, which has the fabulous URL jazz.money, or follow them on Instagram at jazzmoney, followed by several underscores, and make sure to pick up their books, How to Make a Basket and Mark the Dawn, from your local independent bookseller.
And you can follow Eve on Instagram at Eve_Rees.
And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright, or on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
And don't forget that you can catch up on all of seasons 1, 2, 3, 4 and 5 via the website archivefeverpod.com. And you can also listen and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you choose to listen.
So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
Coming up on the next episode.
Afghanistan's a war zone. Gaza was a war zone. And obviously, yes, Gaza right now in Afghanistan was a war zone. That's a fact. But it's so much more than that. There is a beauty about Gaza people don't think about, alongside a brutal occupation. I'm not romanticising it by any means. And Afghanistan was the same.